Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Please note, season one of this podcast was recorded before the passing of our beautiful and brilliant TV mom, Suzanne Summers. Suzanne, we love you, we miss you, and this podcast is dedicated to you.
We're two stepsisters bonded, living Hollywood life. Even if one of us is watching for the very first time, all the good, the bad, the barky, take a peek inside. Let's rewatch and relive the good times. Keep it and they can give you deja vu.
Hi. This is Kenan and Lakin Give You Deja Vu, the rewatch podcast where we will take turns breaking down every episode of the 90s sitcom step by step in order. I'm Christine Lakin and I played Al Lambert.
I'm Stacey Keenan and I played Dana Foster.
And we're going to tell you how it really went down because
we were there.
Now, for one of us, this is the first time watching this series. Stacey, you never watched the show.
Nope, never. Never watched it when it was on. Have never watched it since. So this is the first time seeing the show.
And after like 30 years, you were like, you know what? You know what I haven't seen yet? I should watch that.
Well, for purposes of this podcast, no, if not for this podcast, I would probably never, ever watch it.
Well, I'm glad we're doing this because it's really unearthing your childhood.
You
know, why not?
Oh, yeah, there's that.
Okay, well, today we are going to break down episode 6. This is season 1, episode 6. Title of ep is Pulling Together. Original air date, October 25th, 1991. That's my anniversary.
Oh.
I know. Okay, this episode was a doozy. I don't really know what to think about it, but I'm just gonna go for it. First of all, when we're watching this, as I do with my children, I just want to point out that the littlest one, Baylor, the entire time we're watching the episode, which is 22 minutes, there's no commercials. We're watching it on, you know, digital, it's online. The entire time that he had running commentary. And the only thing he kept saying was, when is it over?
Oh, Baylor.
When is it over? When is it over? Is it over yet?
Okay, did you inform him that he was dead in our demographic?
Yes, he doesn't care. He was
children
not
2 to 17, it. Okay? Just to let you know, the networks actually considered, even then, even in the 90s, even before you had, you know, 10-month-old kids sitting at a table at a restaurant staring at a screen, even way before those days, networks started their demographic at age 2 to 17. Oh. And this show was number one.
Well, tell that to Blippi.
Predominantly for, I don't know, what, the entire run For children 2 to 17. Yeah. So, wow.
No. And then the next
he
one
is
came
a
on.
Shady b-
I know. The next one, because it just goes straight into the next one. He saw the roller coaster and he goes, no.
Oh, jeez. Like, the two it. Of them Calm are down. Terrible.
Terrible. They're
oh,
both
boy.
Very shady. Okay. Well, here, let's jump in anyway, because you know what? I enjoyed it thoroughly.
You did?
I did.
I'm going to say
it was so dumb that
I didn't
was
like this
happening?
Episode. I got mad. I got disappointed. And by the way, for our listeners, our studio audience out there, if you're hearing kind of Jurassic Park sounds in the background, that is because my dog, who is a
mini horse,
a manatee, land manatee, giraffe mix. He just barged into the door, just muscled his way in.
He just put his nose on me and my entire right leg is wet.
Sorry, Lakin. The things that Lakin puts up with to record this show.
You know, it's all for you guys.
And then he just kind of harumphed and jowled his way about the room until finally settling after some huffing and puffing. So if you're wondering what that... why King Kong just entered the podcast, that's because he did.
Okay. Oh, he's anyway. He's about as enthusiastic right now as my son was. So, well, probably won't hear him very much after this.
Yeah, I didn't like this episode.
Okay. No, this episode is ridiculous.
This show,
so dumb.
My heart was kind of broken because after the first few episodes, we kind of had this cathartic moment.
Right.
For any studio audience out there, if you listened to the previous episodes, I was really kind of touched and pleased because one of the previous episodes, I realized the show is funny.
Right.
And the show is kind of good and I liked it and I was so happy and I LOL'd many times already listening totally. Up to this point. And here we are at episode 6. And then here comes episode 6 and breaks my heart. So, and I said, this is bad. This is not good.
It wasn't good.
It is bad. And it is just.
This was one of those just, yeah, I think it was probably better as an outline on paper. And then when we got into it, I just don't think it really took off. So let me get into it. All right. Carol wants to do family things. Carol is somebody who just wants to bring the family together. Don't you think it'd be fun to do some kind of like, you know, family activity? And all the kids are like, yeah, hell no, don't care. Bye. I think Al is like, when pigs fly. Cody comes in and he's like, oh, Frank, you know, there's the big fair is this weekend. And Frank's all excited because this is like something apparently the Lamberts have gone to and done all these activities. And they're like, number one, they're these champs and they have to like hold their title for the state county fair.
Right. The Lamberts always win. And it's these type of, I don't know, field day type of activities, right. You know, the three-legged race and,
right.
You know, bobbing for apples.
Bobbing? Is that a Halloween thing? Or and then this happens at fairs.
Right. And pie eating. It's those types of events.
Right. Relay, tug of war, you know, all the basics. Well, Cody can't go this year because he's going to be doing demo on a donut shop. But Frank is like, oh, it's all right. You know, we'll have to make do without you. And then Carol basically says, oh, what is this? This sounds like a great family activity. And she's all excited to like get the kids involved. So she says, okay, well, I think the kids really want to do it. So finally, Frank says, all right, well, let's go out and practice. Because let's be honest, the foster kids are not really... athletic.
Right.
So they go outside and he has this whole apple bobbing thing set up. Okay. We're going to see who's good at what here. So we get Mark, you know, the youngest, like kind of nerdy from that side. He puts his head in this large trough of water for what feels like he's being waterboarded for like a good 20 seconds.
Right. It seemed like he could definitely die.
He almost drowned in a bucket.
Right.
Finally, they pull him up. He looks like he maybe was, you know, passing out and he's gotten no apples.
So, right. And then he does about 17 spit takes.
Yes.
It just went on for about 5 minutes worth of airtime. Yeah.
And then we basically just decide that they're not going to be good at anything. And they don't want to do it anyway.
Yeah. They have a bad attitude. You know, Dana, as always. Now look, Dana, I'm realizing is horrible, but she is especially horrible in this episode. I mean, I went back and I know you should never do this, but I never read any comments or anything, but on IMDb, there's reviews of the show.
Oh God. We have to start reading these
reviews
on air.
So we should. So I started reading some of them and There were several themes that I noticed. Okay. I didn't read them all. I didn't spend too much time doing
archives,
it.
Archives, I like this.
Right. But what, you know, we could maybe save that for another day. So one of the themes in these comments, in these reviews was, you know, this show is fine. It's, you know, it's a nice family show and all that. But why is Dana such a nightmare? Why is she so unpleasant? Why is she so horrible? No one would want to be around this person. And I can't disagree.
She's definitely, I mean, they've definitely written her to be the one who is the most sort of teenage angsty, I guess. Is that what you would even say? I don't know. She's like, she's the one that is just going to be like the naysayer of everything.
Yes. I don't know. I don't know if it's angst. It's just Dana just hates everything and everyone and is very outspoken about it.
Totally.
So I'm looking forward to seeing how the writers hopefully open Dana up to being more than just being super mean all the time, because right. That can't be her entire personality. I mean, yes, she's supposed to be also uptight and academic and, you know, intellectual and ambitious, but there's got to be more to her than just tearing people down all the time.
Totally. Because it's a very kind of surface trait for a character.
Yeah.
You know, and I think maybe we were still trying to find the characters
right.
as things go, because this is, you know, pretty early on.
Yes. And as we mentioned, there's so damn many of them. The writers are kind of drowning in characters. Like, how do you even
get in there with, you know, if you only have two or three lines to.
And to have, 22 minutes to deal with this, all of these people. But anyhow.
So the kids go inside. They're all like, we don't want to do this, you know, and Frank basically thinks he's talking to his kids and they're like, Dad, just like get out of it. Like, we are never going to win if they're on board. And he's like, yeah, absolutely. I'm going to go in there. I'm going to tell Carol, you know, it's not going to work out and no problem. Right. It's kind of a win-win for him because he's realized that they're terrible. So he goes inside and Carol now has talked to her children and she's like, you know what? We need to pull together as a family. And you are lucky to have a stepfather like Frank, who cares about you and wants to do this stuff with you. And you are not getting out of this. We're going to do it. So she's the one that's now, he's coming to be like, it's fine. You know, your kids don't need to do this. He's sort of almost happy because he realizes they suck.
And then the Lamberts can still win.
And then we can still win.
Protect their title.
Right. The big title at the fair. And then as Carol's now saying all of this to him, he sort of realizes like he can't back down from it because she's going on and on about what a great guy he is and how, you know, he's really bringing them into this. And he's like, okay. And then she does this like crazy thing where she's leaving and she's like, you know, maybe later tonight after the kids go to bed, we can do a workout or something like that as she leaves and she's blowing him kisses and he's sitting at the kitchen table. And then JT comes in and then he like can't get up because he's so turned on. So then he's like,
oh, I didn't notice that he couldn't get up.
Oh, he's son, sit down.
Oh, wow. I didn't even catch that. But that was, for me, the saving grace of this episode was that moment. It was Patrick Duffy kind of being a light in the darkness that was this particular episode. Because when Carol is coming onto him and, you know, I don't know, kind of seducing him about what's going to happen later, he has a stroke. I mean, he kind of has he's so into it that he sort of has this seizure almost where totally. It was a really, really funny reaction that was purely Patrick Duffy. I mean, on paper, there was really, I don't know what was even there. Nothing, probably. Nothing. And he makes it into this whole bit where he kind of strokes out.
Totally.
And then JT comes in. And, you know, because Carol has left and Frank is left behind in the throes of this episode. And then JT comes in.
can't get up. Also, can't really see.
Can't really move. Can barely breathe. Is kind of apoplectic. And then JT comes in and says whatever he says, Dad, or something like that. And Frank. He has this sort of startle / horror reaction because he's having this Carol fantasy and then his kid comes in that kind of just shatters the whole moment.
Totally.
And he has this, anyway, that was the saving grace of this episode for me.
It was very funny.
Thank you, Patrick. Thank you.
And probably not what I probably went straight over my head as a kid, which I think was the point.
Well, listen, the him not being able to stand up thing went over my head today. So good on you.
Yeah. So JT comes in. He's like, Dad, so you know, you told her, right? He's like, you know, son, sometimes in life, and he's giving him this whole thing about how we have to come together. And, you know, it's more important than winning. And then JT's like, he wimped out, you know, comes back to like us in the backyard.
And I don't know if you noticed, this episode was shot real weird. It looks weird. It doesn't look like this show.
No.
It looks different. There was this extreme push, extreme close up of JT in this moment that came out of absolutely nowhere.
I think something weird's happening with the analog of the way the show
is maybe.
That was very strange. I don't think that was actually the way it was shot. For some weird reason, when you're watching this, there are certain shots that are like fuzzy and pushed in for no reason.
But there had to have been I do agree. There's something weird in even the kind of the aspect ratio. Yes. I don't know. But then the close up that had to come. I mean, you don't get a close up unless you shot a close up, right?
So I guess.
And it was the only one in the show. It was so weird. Anyway.
Okay. So they get out to this fair. And by the way, I remember shooting this. We shot it. It was almost like we were shooting a film because when we did this stuff outside, it was outside the Culver Studios, like we talked about. It's this big kind of plantation-y looking mansion. And they made it look like some city hall.
Yeah, fair, city hall, town square. Hall. And it was hotter.
So hot.
Than hell.
I do.
Watching this,
very hot.
I remember the heat.
Yes. And I was wearing a cutoff sweatshirt and sweatpants.
And then if you can imagine this, so imagine Southern California, full hot sun, and then they put the lights on you.
Mm-hmm.
So the next time you're watching something, probably the easiest way to notice this is if you're watching something that involves people in a car, especially if it's people in a car at night.
Yeah.
Whether it's a movie or a TV, notice how brightly lit their faces are and maybe ask yourselves, where in real life would that light be coming from? The answer is nowhere, nowhere. In real life, it would just be damn dark in that car. But if you can see everyone's face, it's because there are these hot, hot, hot lights, usually from underneath, coming up, and then they have to fill in front somehow. Oh, but
we're
imagine
the surface of the sun straight in your face.
Yeah, and then you have the actual sun, which is bright enough, and then these blinding, bright, hot lights. And then you can't have sunglasses on, of course.
No.
And then they're telling you, at least
they're
telling me, open your eyes, because especially if you have lighter eyes and your eyes are just so sensitive to the sun, and then you're squinting super hard and making this awful squinty face, which does not look good on camera. So they're telling you, open your eyes. And you're trying to, you know, force your eyes wide open, and the light is just, ooh! Anyway, not to say, oh, our lives were so hard or this is difficult, but just to give you an idea, if you have not been on a set outside with those lights, just to give you a little window into what that feels like.
I have to be really careful now, and I don't know if it's just because I'm older or what, but when I'm directing and they're moving lights around there, and there's some really bright ones, especially if they're using bounce and stuff, I think because I watch a monitor all day, so that's already a certain amount of strain, but I will get a migraine like in 5 minutes if I'm not really careful about shielding my eyes.
Yeah.
Okay. So we get into the, I don't know, field day, whatever this is, picnic, fair, extravaganza.
Oh, it's the Port Washington 16th Annual Family Games.
Oh, here we go.
Yes, there's a banner hanging on the front of that plantation
house
thing.
Yeah, it's cotton candy and popcorn, and it's just a whole big thing. So now the biggest rivals, the Larson family, sort of comes up to the Lambert family, and they start having this back and forth. And now this is really where, it gets confusing. The Larson family is like a large group of Norwegians?
I would love for an accent coach. Write to us, will you? Now listen, this is no shade to this actor. He was funny, I thought. And I think he was having fun with it. I don't think he was trying to realistically portray anything necessarily in terms of an accent. It was a funny accent. I liked it. Was it German?
No, I think.
Was it Swedish?
I think
it Norwegian?
Was. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Norwegian?
Yeah. If you think about Port Washington, Wisconsin, I don't know really. I don't know anybody that talks like this, but it was meant to be kind of Midwestern-y, Amish-y, maybe also Norwegian.
Okay.
Work. So this entire family travels together. They're all big Norwegian types. They look very strong and they look very sort of, you know, they're all like, oh, ha, ha, you know.
Yeah.
We're talking in this crazy accent. And, Frank Lambert. Yo, we see you now. out of the left field. They're all eating like chicken legs
and they're cobs just
of corn.
Very big, very solidly built people.
Yes. And so the relays start beginning. First, it's apples and the Lambert family crushes, right? It's Brendan and it's JT and it's Frank and they all get apples and we crush. Yay. Okay. So we've got a point there. Then we get into like a relay race and it's Karen and Al. And Al's like trying to, you know, coach Karen and this is what you're going to do. And you know, she gets the baton and then she stops. Oh no, I've broken a nail.
I was watching this saying, please don't tell me that Karen is going to take that baton and then say that she broke a nail. And then 3 seconds later, that's exactly what happened. And I was so mad and disappointed.
Don't worry. There's a comeuppance there. And then it's that whole thing where you ring the bell. I don't even know what you call that.
It's kind of a carnival game where it's a strongman thing.
Right.
Where you take that big old sledgehammer thing and you swing it over your shoulder and then you come crashing down on that pad. And then you're trying to see if you can hit it hard enough so that the little whatever travels all the way to the top and ding, hits the bell.
And of course, on the Larson side, he does it great. And why was he? But then he's matched up with poor Chris Castile, Mark, who can't even like hold the hammer.
Right. So maybe this is not a. Right. Why isn't it? Yeah. Maybe it's not that the Fosters are so wimpy and weak. Maybe it's that the Lamberts have terrible skills in designating who is doing which of these games. Because, yeah, that's horrible. Why do you have the kid who weighs 50 pounds?
Hold up a 50-pound mallet.
Right, which, of course, he falls over like a little leaf blown in the breeze.
Ugh. So, by the way, I have this weird feeling, and I think I might be right, but we'd have to look back at IMDb. The gentleman who's playing one of the Larson kids, who does the hammer, the mallet, I think that was Matt Warren's son. Matthew Warren was one of our producers.
It's Michael Warren.
I'm sorry, Michael Warren. Sorry. I think that's Matt.
Oh, really?
His name is Matt. Yeah.
Okay.
Matt, if you're listening, you have to tell me if that's you. I'm pretty sure it's you.
Yes. There were definitely
My mom would remember.
Who looked familiar, but I wasn't too sure.
Yeah. Cause he had blonde hair. I mean, he was less sort of character-y, I'll put it that way, than maybe some of the other family members. He was sort of like good looking one of the group. He was like less like, I mean, they had a gentleman playing one of the, they were like, oh, they're like, oh, your son, da, da, da. He goes, that's my daughter. But it was clearly not a man with earrings on.
That was, I am still thinking about that.
That joke.
Yeah. So we have rather a big and burly person, tall and very solid. And yeah.
Sort of a close, like cropped curly haircut. And he's like, oh, your son is, he makes some mention of like, oh, your son. He's like, son, that's my daughter.
Right. And then we cut to the, who we now realize is the daughter, who, yes, is wearing earrings and lipstick and kind of leans forward and does a little flirty wave. So I was wondering, and I did think, I think that's a dude. I think we put a man.
Correct.
In drag.
That's correct. I don't know how we feel about it.
I don't know.
I don't think that's going to hold up, guys. That joke does not, it's not going to track today.
Look, everyone. There was something about it that was kind of funny because the joke is these people are such I don't know, just big, strong people that this woman is so...
They're all like tall bunion types.
Yes, tall and broad and strong that we didn't at first realize, but just some... I'm still thinking about it and I still don't really know what to make of it. At the same time, I'm confused because it was funny.
Yes.
So I don't know where to go with that. But you know, with that, shall we take a break?
Yeah, get ready. There's a real cliffhanger coming. Ooh, who's going to win? We'll be right back. Deja vu.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Okay, we're back. Now listen. It's the third act, all right? The Lambert family is not winning this. They are down to the wire. They're in second place, and Frank is freaking out.
Which I didn't even know how they were in second place.
I don't either, because
they're doing terrible. They're miscasting. The only who should be doing what games?
The only thing they've won is a bobbing for an apple. I mean, how hard is that? FYI.
Yeah, what kind of an athlete are you for that task? But anyway.
So Frank is freaking out and he's like, you don't understand. You know, there are no awards in construction. No one's telling me, oh, great job on that drywall, Frank. Like, this is the thing. This is what I have. Of course, he's like, we're trying to come back to this like emotional moment of like why this means so much to him.
Right. Why does Frank care so much?
Why does Frank care so much? And, you know, and of course he's having this freak out with Carol and she's sort of like, you know, oh, I didn't know I married such like a macho, you know, crazer basically. Mm-hmm. And so, and as they're speaking, I think Penny comes up and she just starts tying their legs together because apparently they're going to do the three-legged race together. So they're having this whole like argument. And then of course they end up falling on top of each other at the very end because they're tied together. And right then the Larsons come up. It's the dad and I guess his daughter that we've just spoken about. And they're just doing perfectly. And they see, you know, Carol and Frank on the ground on top of each other, like, get a room, which, you know, given the course of the last five episodes.
Fair enough.
So now is the very last event and it's a pie eating contest. And JT is meant to be doing this against Leif, who is the very large sort of Norwegian,
Viking-esque
son, and he comes over eating like some kind of disgusting looking, very sloppy milkshake. And JT says something like, oh, aren't you going to save room for the pie eating contest? And he's like, oh, please, this is just a snack. Like, I'm going to destroy you. And while he's talking to him, Karen saunters by, and all of a sudden, Leif just is in a trance. He can't do anything.
He's hypnotized.
And then he like falls backward over a hay bale. And like, you know, and so funny as we're watching this again, my son is like, is it over yet? And my husband goes, oh, when he fell over that hay bale, he really should have just tried to make the milkshake go everywhere. And I was like, oh, nice point, Brandon. Brandon was like trying to up the like.
Wait, didn't the milk? I think the milkshake did go everywhere.
But he wanted it to be like on him. I was like, they probably didn't have doubles.
Yeah, he spilled it on himself. But yeah, it didn't sort of explode.
He was like, oh, you really missed a moment there.
Wow.
I was like, oh, thanks, Brandon.
Brandon is keyed in to, because that is the step-by-step MO. Any kind of food sight gag, you would absolutely have producers on the sidelines wanting you to
just get it all over your
just
face.
Just get it everywhere. The biggest explosion possible. But yeah, somehow that did not, you're right. It went onto the front of his shirt, but it wasn't, you know, a mushroom cloud.
Right. Oh, newsflash. So, this is also the first time my husband has ever watched the show.
Is he shady too?
He's not nearly as shady as my children.
He's
not
just, nearly. Just mildly.
Mildly. But he, in general, I think he's actually thinks it's pretty funny and he didn't realize what a goofball Patrick Duffy was. Oh. He's like, oh, he's like a real goofball.
And I was yeah. No, he was, yeah, that's maybe what people don't realize. Dallas and all that was Patrick having to act serious.
Right.
Which is not his natural mode. No. This is Patrick's true milieu,
yes,
if you will.
Definitely. Like, I feel like he was like doing all of this behind the scenes Dallas. And then they would 100%. Be like action. And then he would like turn on the
blue steel. And then all of a sudden he does his blue steel face.
Right.
And that's how he gets through the episode. And then the second they
just clenching his butt cheeks, just being as like serious as he can. And then he's like, you know.
And then he does a nose bump on a fake nose right. bump on a door the second they cut.
Yeah, totally. But he is a bit shady on the like, every time they, you know, they go, he was laughing about Patrick basically having like a stroke. He was like, he goes, oh my God, every time she looks at him, he's basically, he turns into like a puddle. I'm like, yeah, that's all. That's yeah. the gag. Okay. So JT realizes that maybe he's got an ace in the pocket here because Leaf can't do anything around Karen because he's in love with her. So JT makes sure that Karen is going to do the pie eating contest. Now, everybody is like freaking out about this because, as Frank says, he's never seen Karen eat. So they sit down.
Also troubling. That one also got an eyebrow from me.
He's never seen Karen eat?
Yeah. You know, okay.
Because beautiful thin girls are not supposed to eat.
Beautiful thin girls or truthfully, she actually was not eating right. in order to be that skinny.
Yeah, that's a troubling message.
Yeah.
So they sit down to have a pie eating contest, and Karen's really going for it at this point. Hi, Leaf, as she sits down, and she's making all these kind of goo-goo eyes at him, and she's sort of like blowing him kisses. And then she goes over right before it starts, and she like plants this kiss on his cheek. And this kid is just like transfixed by her. And so they start the pie eating contest. No one's doing anything. And that she's just making all these eyes at him.
And she's kind of flirting with him in this. It's like a cartoon.
It's
like when Bugs Bunny dresses up as a, you know, Southern lady with an enormous hoop skirt. And he's saying to the, you know, whatever, the hunter, you know, the hunter that's looking for Bugs Bunny, well, good morning, sir. And, you know, batting the eyelashes and flirting or whatever. That's what this is.
Yeah.
As played by Angela Watson, she's just having a gay old time with this.
Oh, yeah. And then finally, the judge says, well, someone's got to eat something.
Or else no one wins.
Right. And so she takes one tiny little blueberry. And
or a cherry, I thought it was.
Maybe a cherry.
Again, this is why people say this is a horny show.
It's very.
Because
there's a 15-year-old basically seducing another 15-year-old at a pie eating contest.
With essentially what I interpreted, or I thought it was a cherry. And she kind of picks it up very coyly and then just sort of pops it into her mouth in this way that is... It's
highly
straight
sexually
out of
charged.
Lolita. I don't know what. Yeah.
And this poor Leaf just is so blown away by it that he just falls face first into his pie and she wins.
More food gags.
And so now it's like the very, very last. Now we're tied. That was the thing that got us to the tie. And now it's the very last event. It's the tug of war. And there's no way we're going to win this tug of war against all these like brutish large people. So
it's like it is a family of bears versus a family of squirrels.
Yes. So it gets started. They're clearly start to win. We're like, we're losing. And then out of the blue,
who do you think is going to arrive?
Vroom, vroom.
None other than
the code man
on his motorcycle.
Like the shot was like something out of, I don't know. It was like some kind of film, like some Hellraiser film where he's just in all of his leathers and plaids.
Yeah, and he got his leather vest on. It's kind of, I don't know. Is it Jesus rolling up in his chariot? I don't know. It was, and the whole thing, the music, that the way it was shot, everything.
Like he comes in this hero shot on the motorcycle. And he looks over and he sees that we're losing and he just pops in there and he's like, hey, the code man's here to save the day. And he just like pops in and they're like, wait a minute. That's not fair. Family only. And he says, of course I'm family. I'm her fiance, looking down at Dana. And Dana's like, what? Like appalled. And then realizes, oh no, wait.
We need him.
We got to win. So she's like, sure.
Hi, honey.
But here's he actually is family.
Yes.
So
okay.
Why are we saying he's, why are issues. We lying?
He's Frank's nephew. So he is family. I don't know. Is there some kind of rule in the bylaws of these games that everyone has to live in the same household?
But what makes a, like a fiance isn't even, don't you think that cousin trumps fiance in that?
I would think. I don't know. And then no one batted an eye at the fact that Dana is maybe 16.
Right.
And she's betrothed to this gentleman, this man. No one has any issue with a child bride, nope. with being married to this clearly adult man. Everyone's more concerned with the bylaws of the Port Washington 16th annual family games.
That's right. Of course, he comes in, he saves the day, and
right, because one code man is stronger than this army of enormous Norwegian Viking superhuman people.
No offense, but I do feel like if that family, the Larsons, were going to have a mascot, it might be your dog. I mean, doesn't yes. he look like he could belong?
He absolutely does. He's kind of, he's a polar bear.
He is.
He's enormous.
I mean, it would have been perfect, honestly.
He would definitely walk around eating a chicken leg if he could. He would, if he wore clothes, overalls would be his item, which yes. is what the Larson's kind of signature look is, that the yeah, dad is rocking.
So they win. It's exciting. They get the trophy. All the kids are sitting, you know, in front of Frank and Carol, and they're about to take their picture. And then, of course, as always happens, the kids start fighting, and the snap is Frank and Carol freeze frame, so excited, holding the trophy, and the kids are all just like fighting and like throwing things and like pushing, you know, hitting each other with stuffed animals and things like that.
Yeah. So even though we pulled together title of the episode to literally prevail right. as a family, as a unit, we still have to go back to the theme of the show, which is, hey, this is not the Brady Bunch. Things are not perfect. This is a step family that's trying to merge. We don't have perfect harmony here.
Yeah.
And that's really the photo for the newspaper. You know, the town newspaper is, you know, the kids have already devolved back into chaos
yes.
and hating each other.
This episode was so weird. I mean, it was just, I feel like it was meant to be sort of a standalone of like, okay, we're going to go.
We can put this anywhere in the season.
Yep.
And they, you notice they didn't put this in the first few episodes when they were trying to get an audience, get people to notice the show, like the show, stay with the show, mm-hmm. because this was not a very good show. They kind of,
but it
they
was
just
a very
stuck it in a little later.
Episode.
Yeah. You can only imagine. I was even thinking the beginning of the show. Of this one, there was this big sax kind of part that played.
Mm-hmm.
You just don't get that anymore.
No.
You don't have musicians in a studio recording a kind of a little
bumpers?
Sax sting thing. Wow.
I know. It was intense. I also want to say that, you know, people have asked if it's Suzanne Summers singing the theme song. It is not.
She does sing. And she has a lovely voice. And she was a huge, she had a Vegas show that
yes.
was huge for years.
I feel like she could have. She definitely could have been singing it.
Yes.
It is not her. But it was interesting as I was listening to the titles one more time before the episode aired. And I was thinking to myself, like, I feel like I understand why people think it's her. Because it kind of sounds like it maybe could be. But you know who is singing in the beginning? They had a lot of children singing as well. I don't know if you really listen to the whole thing, there's a step-by-step when they start singing.
The kids sing the chorus.
There's kids in there. Allison Mack.
What?
Yep.
Is one of the kids in the chorus?
That's correct.
Wow.
Yeah.
How do you know that? Well, you were friends with her.
I knew her. She told me that years later. And I think she would still get like, you know, 5 cents every time it aired or whatever, you know, whatever the ASCAP, yeah, residual was for it. Weird, right? It's like so strange. Sliding doors.
Wow. Yeah, that's pretty wild.
That's a trivia fact for you.
I did that kind of work as a kid too. And it was really fun because yeah, back then it was more common to just spend a lot of money on a jingle,
Weren't you the voice of My Little Pony?
Yes, I was. Yes, for a certain period of time, for, I don't know, a couple of years there, I sang all the My Little Pony jingles.
Was that the My Little Pony? You can comb her hair.
Is it that? No. It's My Little Pony. They were all different because it was, they were all the different products. So it was, you know, this one has wings. This one has, you know, these long, this one has sparkles on it. This one changes color if you get it wet. And so they all had these different names. And so you had to sing all the different, you know, all the different ones. Yeah. So I would go in and record, you know, however many at a time per session, right, and then come back, you know, next month and do the next batch. And then I sang song for the movie.
Oh, wow.
And they didn't pay me.
What?
Yep.
What do you mean they didn't pay you?
They didn't pay me any royalties. They paid me a session fee, but then they did not pay the royalties that they, and they never have for that. But anyway.
What would you have to do back then? Would you have to like sue them?
So my mom went to the union. Now, listen, I was, I don't know, 9 years right. old or 10, but we needed the money. Believe me, we needed that money. So my mom went to the union. It was AFTRA at the time who was in charge of that because it was, you know, recorded, right, not video, not visual. And AFTRA said, you know, this is not, we won't get involved if it's under a certain amount. And this is under that certain amount.
Oh, come on.
So if you want, and it was not a, it wasn't tiny, you know, right. I mean, it was a theme song for a movie.
Right.
But they still said it was under their threshold and we would have to hire a lawyer and we couldn't afford to hire a lawyer. So I just never got paid any royalties.
You know, what's so up. I mean, I feel like this happens so often, and it especially happened to young people in this business for that kind of same reason. People just, you would do this work, and then even now, it's so strange. Every now and then, I'm like, wait a minute, I did that job like 3 months ago. Where the hell's my paycheck? Mm-hmm. And then I spend so much time hunting down my paycheck. It's eye rolling. And I have a friend who's a writer and it's like the same thing. She says the same thing. She's like, oh yeah, nobody wants to pay. And then you have to hunt them down and then you have to get your lawyer to call or.
We have talked before on this podcast about the Sodom and Gomorrah that is this industry and studio audience. If you've heard that, it's true.
Yeah.
Now look, we were protected from that on this show because there were, this is not to say that just to make things sound cute and sweet. This is true. These people on this show were quality people and the best producers, truly good and nice people who did not engage in that stuff. They were great people. They cared about people. They treated people well. They were great, great people. So we were sort of in this bubble for all, and not just for all those years that the show went on.
Yeah.
That we lived in this kind of safe world where the rest of the industry around us and around the show was exactly what we're saying. I mean, I've said it before, but what industry do you get away with that? What other industry can you just be, oh, well, I'll take your work and then you're going to have to hunt me and beg me and plead and cajole and harass and threaten to get me to pay you for work that you already did. Look, I know what happens in other industries. I know this is not, you know, but how common it is in this industry and to think that people just go, yep, that's the way we do business around here. It's bad.
Yeah. And especially when you're a freelancer, because we don't, not everybody, myself included, I don't just have one job. I have like 10, 12, 15, 20 some odd jobs a year doing all kinds of different things.
Right.
And so then you're like, I have like a calculator. It's like my other part-time job is
keeping track
of what I've gotten paid
who
for.
Who hasn't paid you?
And when I did that job and like, come on. Yeah. It makes me nuts. We were talking a little bit last time about, you know, what it was like to go back to school and have this like other life outside of our job and, you know, what we did there. But I also wanted to touch on, you know, so much of what we did, like you said, we really had this like really incredible group around us. And becoming friends with so many of the crew was also something for me that I loved. Again, I feel like that paved the way for, because I had such a great experience, it like paved the way for me to maybe do what I do now because I just love crew and I love the camaraderie of it and I love the team sport of it. But I just wanted to like kind of call out some of the people that, you know, that I remember and that I remember like always hanging around. Like there were definitely a couple of crew crushes for me even early on.
Really?
Yes. Do you remember Carlos?
Yes.
Yes. So Carlos was the camera AC. He was like one of the assistant camera operators.
Yeah, or focus puller or something like that.
But he would always do the clapboard. So first it was Sean. Sean was this like, kind of like long-haired, like kind of surfer dude, like kind of looked like he would be at a Dead concert. And Sean was like a total sweetheart. And I like just loved him so much. And they would be very close to us because we would be standing, you know, on set, and they would come to do the clapboard and they would have to do it like right in front of us. So, and a lot of times they'd be waiting around and you would just chit chat with them and, you know, shoot the shit or whatever.
Yeah. And if they're pulling focus, they have to measure.
Yeah.
Pull a measuring tape basically up to the tip of your nose.
Yeah. And you would have to stand really still. And so again, sometimes they would be waiting, and now they do all of that electronically. There's no more tape measurers. but anyway, they were Sean was, I really liked. And then Carlos was like, I think the last 5 years. He was so cute.
Super cute.
Yeah. And all of those, you know, all of those camera crew, like Glenn, and it was really, I don't know. It was awesome. It was really cool that they were like that.
Real family environment. But on the flip side of that, something I wondered about this episode. Well, wait, before we get into this, maybe we should take a break.
Okay.
Let's take a break.
All right, let's take a break. Deja vu.
And we're back. So what I was about to say is, yes, so, you know, we did have a great crew who were very, you know, family oriented and made it truly feel like a family. That gets said too much. You know, here at Walgreens, we're a family. No, right. No, we're not. No, we are not. This is a job.
No, we're not.
I can't wait to quit. And we ain't family. But this really did come to feel like that, especially as the years went by. But, and I want to know about this for you as a director, who the director is on any given week really changes things.
That's true.
And at least on this show, directors came and went. You know, we would have some directors that came back a lot and were very consistent. Other times we might have a different director every week, maybe while those other, our usual directors were unavailable or whatever.
And that's common. I mean, everyone in episodic television usually rotates. Very seldom would you have one director for the entire season, unless it's like a limited series or something like that.
Right.
So it's common, but usually you get down to like, you know, it becomes like your three standbys. Basically.
Yeah.
But then every now and then a new person or
new people come in.
They need to plug someone in because no one else is available or whatever.
Right. And certain directors just didn't vibe. There just wasn't that same feeling. So we had one particular director who I remember who kind of showed up and was directing a scene with all the kids in it. And he just announced he was directing either Patrick or Suzanne, and he said something, or maybe it was actually directed to one of the kids, and he said, he was trying to explain what he wanted, and he said, yeah, you know how kids are. Kids are selfish.
Yes, I remember this.
And it's not that he's wrong. Kids can be very selfish, and I think that's a known trait of children that they grow out of, hopefully, but wow, what a thing to say to a group of children! So that was one. Another thing that of this particular director, idiosyncrasy, is that he couldn't get any of our names right. I understand there were a lot of us. And I understand that for him, we were maybe kind of just interchangeable and just annoying too many people that he had to move around on this set and figure out how to shoot them all and whatever. But he would get our names wrong. So he would say, I need Angela Watkins in here. And where's that Christina Legskins? To this day, I may occasionally call Lake in here Lakeskins. And that's where that comes from. And I may call Angela Watson. I may call her Watkins. So that's where that came from. But
wasn't he always calling Josh Jason?
Yeah.
I think he was.
He just couldn't.
And Josh Byrne was Jason.
I'm just saying. You know, and then I also remember another comment.
I mean, you got to study that call sheet. That's what I do. And I have to admit, on the first day, because I study it beforehand and I look at everybody's faces on IMDb and I do my best, but you're learning all these actors' names and their character names.
Right. You have to know the character names.
And you're learning your camera operators' names and
the whole crew.
The
first AD and the second AD.
Like the first day. And it's kind of like overwhelming.
So are you like The Bachelor? Are you standing in a room where there's headshots of people and you're just gazing at them
and I'm giving them roses
and
that
gazing
day.
And you're sort of looking pensive?
I mean, I do a lot of, I definitely do my work to try to, as best I can, at least, like, it, at the very least, I have to memorize who is who in terms of the characters, right? That's the most important thing. You need to know who's there. And then I do my best to, like, really get to know each one of them. And that's very helpful. Because as you have these like side conversations, then you get to know the people behind the character, and you know, it's, there's not a lot of time.
It falls into place, but yeah, you kind of jump in there on day one.
You jump in on day one, and there is no, it's like, hi everyone. Hi, I'm your director. Okay. And we're on the clock, and everyone's looking at you.
Here we go.
There's no, like, let's sit down and have a chat, you know?
We're off to the races.
Maybe I can say, can we read through it once? And as we're reading through it, I'm like, again, I'm looking at everybody. I'm thinking about my blocking, and I'm like trying to memorize everybody's name and every, and sometimes I just say to an actor, I'm sorry, I'm going to call you by your character name for a minute. I'm just trying to get us into the scene, so I hope you don't take that personally. Like, some actors hate to be called by their character names.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I can. Yeah, that I can see that. Another director comment that I remember talking about, you know, kids growing up and that awkward stage and, you know, changing and becoming an adult or whatever. And he said, you know, your daughter's just a kid. And then all of a sudden, one day you realize she's got legs up to here and connected in the middle.
No.
Yes.
No.
Yes.
Not appropriate.
That was the line.
No.
And I died a little bit.
I know.
Just the implications of that comment. Anywho, my point is, some directors just didn't vibe. They just didn't vibe out. And other directors vibed out real hard.
Yeah.
And I wonder for you, now here's another thing I'm going to say. Yeah. This was the early 90s. We did have they were few and far between. We had a couple of female directors. But the truth is,
I remember one.
When they showed up, or maybe it was just one, maybe it was she, not they, the crew didn't like them.
Yeah.
And from day one, straight up. And honestly, even if, knowing nothing, seemingly nothing else about this director, the fact that she was a woman, now the crew is overwhelmingly male,
mm-hmm.
overwhelmingly, and even this, you know, even these lovely people, that was just kind of the vibe in at that yep. time, that there was just right off the bat, this kind of eye roll and yep. a little bit of an edge and hostility. And, you know, if you've never been on a set, the director is the highest boss on the set. Even more so, once you're on that set, more so than the people from the network, more so than the executive producers, anybody from the production company, the director is the boss, and the director is responsible for everything, and the director will answer for everything. So on a set, you know, if you have traditional crew people that, you know, are experienced, mm-hmm. you know, IATSE crew right. members, they call the director sir, and it's yes, sir. And they, when they are asked to do something, they'll go running. I mean, it's like that. And
there is a little bit of a ship mentality.
Yes, it's very hierarchical. Mm-hmm. And the director is at the very, very top. So I wonder for you as a female director who maybe drops into a show, yeah. or do you still feel that? I mean, cause you know, you show up, you're young and you right. look young and you are very petite and yep. you're a gal.
It's definitely interesting. I mean, I think the culture has changed a lot since 1991. Thank God. I think being a female director, especially in episodic comedy in 1991, was an anomaly. We could probably look at archives of the DGA, but I would love to know the number of women, and I guarantee
Directors Guild
you,
of America.
Yeah, Directors Guild. I guarantee you the amount of women that were directing episodic comedy at that time is under 10. I would guarantee you. Now it's better, but the numbers are still really low, and it takes a lot of, for people, if you want to normalize something, people need to see it over and over and over again, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you're not familiar with it and it feels foreign, change is very hard, especially if you've been doing your job for so long, say, in a union, and you've always taken your direction from, you know, a certain type of person, aka male.
A man.
It takes a long time to recognize that that's not the way it always goes. So what's interesting for me is I have definitely felt, and I don't know if it's a male-female thing, but I think that there have been times I've stepped on a set and I don't look like what people are expecting. And if that's because I'm a woman, if that's because I'm 5'1", if that's because I look younger than some of the old guard, it could be a lot of those things. But there have been times where I've literally been chit-chatting with somebody, and we've been having a very nice conversation, and I'm waiting, for rehearsal to begin, and I'm kind of looking around and watching people, and they go, "So what do you do?" And I go, "Oh, I'm the director." And to watch their face go,
"Really?"
Eyes get huge, and then it becomes, "Oh God, wait, you are?" I don't know what they thought I was doing there. But I'm sure they had some stereotype in their head of what women usually do on sets.
Costumer, hair, makeup, maybe props, but right. Not usually. Maybe set prop dressing. Assistant, set dressing, set decorating.
Right. And then then it's very interesting how the tone changes quickly.
Well, because you're Sir. So if correct. That's a crew person who's talking to you, then they just realize they're talking to the top boss on right. that set and then for the rest of that like, shoot.
What have I said?
Yeah.
Oh, how have I act? Oh God. And I mean, I'm not like that. I'm very warm and I don't yell. I don't scream. And I think that's also that's also a mentality of old guard too. I think I had someone come up to me and talk to me at the end of this last thing I did, and this crew person was being very complimentary and just saying like what a pleasure it was to work with me and, how I always had time for them and I was very thoughtful in my answers and very warm. And I thought, that's so nice of you to say, and thank you for saying so. And also, why wouldn't I be? Like, what have you experienced? You've seen traumatized.
Who hurt you?
Who hurt you?
But that's the industry, because you do. You have directors who yell and scream, and at least at this time. Now, we didn't have a lot of that on this show.
No.
You occasionally had a director who would have a tense moment and might yell for a second. But that would be isolated and mostly at the crew, not yelling at the kids or anything like that.
Right.
But that is absolutely something that was accepted. And no one, people might kind of have an eye roll or everyone would get a little tense, but it wasn't an anomaly or how dare this person do this. That is completely accepted. Or I don't know if things have changed now. You would have to tell me, but
I think people still scream. I do.
Yeah, because you're allowed. And especially the director is absolutely allowed. As the highest boss, they can absolutely do that.
It's not the way I would conduct a set. I mean, sometimes you have to raise your voice so people can hear you, especially right. if you're outside.
And in these huge spaces, a huge stage.
Yeah.
Which is enormous.
But having a full on like freak out is just like, I've gotten frustrated for sure.
Yeah.
I've taken a deep breath, walked away and broken a pencil. That's happened. Yes. I broke a pencil in my hands. And then I took a deep breath and I was like, okay. All right. Okay.
And we're back.
But I would never.
That's a good sign that person wanted to say that to you, because they must think that they must think that you have power and that you're coming back and that they need to make sure that you like them.
I am coming back.
See, how did I know? Because they might have been thinking that, but to go so far as to actually say it, they are recognizing your power.
I think the other thing is that's very important and what I try to make sure I do right from the get-go, because you have to show people you know what you're doing.
And right? That was the thing. It seemed like, at least in our day, back on the show anyway, that the assumption was, the prejudiced right. presumption was, oh, this woman is directing. She's not going to know what she's doing. And we're going to be here all night long. Right. And that she was going to be slow.
Right.
Because that's the thing on these shows. The crew wants things to move fast. And they like the directors who show up. They're decisive. We're doing this. We're doing this. We're doing this. And the show moves fast.
Right.
And, I remember those comments of, what's her face is directing. We're going to be here all night long.
Right.
That she's not going to know.
Those comments still happen, FYI.
No. How do you, like, to you?
Nope. But I hear them about other directors.
Female directors?
Not exclusively, But I have on a show I work on, I've heard, like, you know, because everybody kind of talks about everybody. I do not engage in that conversation because I don't think it's helpful. But I have heard, like, you know, oh, well, so-and-so is directing this week. Yeah, it's been a long night. Ugh. And, like, the kind of the eye roll of, like, and listen, you know, I understand it. Crews work really hard anyway. And when someone doesn't come in prepared or doesn't have a good plan, it's frustrating for everyone else because you're tied. Your hands are tied. There's nothing you can do. You can only, like, kind of wait around until that person figures out what they want. And if you change the lighting 5 times and the blocking 5 times, like, it's wasting everyone's time and it's wasting money.
And the crew is stuck. The crew can't say, oh, you know what?
You should try this. Like, that's out of your realm. You're not allowed
again,
to do that.
Again, that hierarchy, the crew can't really do that. And the crew also can't say, oh, that's my 10 hours or that's my 12 hours. The end of my shift. Good night, everyone. The crew is there until it's done. Right. So these are people who might work 17 hours, 20 hours.
And then drive home.
That is not, and then drive home and then come back the next day. That's not an exaggeration. And I think for crew, the union rule is what, an 8-hour turnaround?
Yep.
So in other words, that's, you know, if you end at midnight.
Maybe 10 now.
Okay. But the soonest you can call them back the next day is that whatever that union does, you know, 8 or 10 hours. For actors, it used to be 12 hours.
I think it still is.
You know, because of course we have to look pretty in front of the cameras. That's
We need our extra rest. We're there early. We're pre-lighting. People are moving set pieces in. I get there early. Sometimes I block with second team, which is the stand-ins that come in.
Yeah. And it's heavy physical labor that they're doing. They're moving these massive lights and C-stands and sandbags and actual sets and carrying things and driving. Yeah. It's physical, very well paid physical labor, but very heavy labor. Yeah.
I think the thing that was, like, one of the best pieces of advice someone gave me was in a DGA workshop I took. And when you do a tech scout, which is for single camera shows, they don't really do tech scouts as much for like multicam, but a tech scout is when you go to the location, you've already scouted your location. Say we need to film at this, you know, this house in Pasadena. And we've decided which house we like, because I've gone with everybody and I said, I think this is the best house. Let's use this one. So by the time we get there, we have decided we bring in a mini crew. It's usually your DP, your gaffer, you know, maybe some of the art department, so that people can just, you basically are showing them, this is how I plan to shoot this. And this is what the scene is. So everybody understands on the day, now do your measurements. Where are you going to be bringing in your electricity? What time of day are we shooting? Which way do we want to go first? Like, we're just logistically figuring out all the technical elements. And the best thing you can do is to come in, and on that day, maybe your first AD will gather everybody and say, okay, everyone, you know, this is Christine. She's going to be directing this episode. Christine, take it away. And in that moment, It's your moment to either gain their trust or lose it. And if you know exactly what you're doing and you're not holding a script, you know exactly what you want. You're telling everyone what you want. Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for being here. Really looking forward to this week. So here's what I'd like to do. And you're very direct about it. And you're very, like, thoughtful about it. And it doesn't look like you're fumbling around and, like, you're not really sure. Like, that's the moment that people are like, okay, I'll trust you. Sure. I mean, I don't know you yet, but you have a plan and I'll go along with it.
Yeah.
And then you, throughout, you know, the week of thanking people, learning their names, thanking departments, thanking them for a great day. When they do something really wonderful at lunch, thank you so much. That looked beautiful. I really appreciate that. You know, letting them know that you see their work. Like, that's how you build the community.
And then you show them that you are a leader and then you know how to lead. I mean, do you feel sometimes, though, that you have to say things differently? I mean, you're ordering around people. That's part of being a director. You know, all right, we need this over here. We're going to change this up. And you're telling people what to do. Do you feel like as a female director, you have to, instead of saying, hey, all right, that's gonna shift left. Put that, you know, do you feel like you have to
say it in a certain way?
Yeah.
I don't. Because I've just decided that I'm going to be me no matter what. And I'm kind about the way I say things, but I don't censor myself. Like, I've watched people do something and I'm like, no, what are we doing? Okay, everybody stop, time out. We need to refocus. Like, I'm very direct about it. Mm-hmm. But I'm kind, but I'm not worried about being disliked, I guess. Do you know? I know I'm coming in with a plan and you're either on board or you're not, you know? So
right.
I guess I just don't want to play that game. I've seen it. If people want to continue to, like, at the end of the day, I feel like generally people want to do their job and they want to do it well. And if everybody's on board with a good plan, then you generally have everybody's favor. I think when you lose favor is when you don't have a good plan. I think when you're wasting everybody's time, when you're waffling around, or when you're just blatantly screaming at everyone. I've watched directors just scream at people. Mm-hmm. Just in like very high pitched, just like annoying tones, you know, no one likes to be screamed at all day. They just don't. So I don't know.
Well, that's good to hear. That's good to hear. And it's good to hear. It sounds like it's working for you.
Yeah. I mean, to my face anyway, I don't know if anyone's been, I have not really, aside from the sort of surprise that I am the person that they're listening to that week, that initial shock, I haven't experienced, you know, people blatantly not paying attention or eye rolling, or I really haven't experienced that.
Well, that's encouraging.
It is encouraging.
That is encouraging.
Because I mean, listen, I'm prepared for everything, and that maybe that will happen. I'm not saying it won't, but I think now the culture is get on board or get out.
Ooh. Okay. Well, that's encouraging.
Yeah.
Yeah. I directed a short years ago. Short film. And one of the people on the crew, it was a small crew, you know, it was an independent short film. And he asked, you know, it was, I don't know, the first day or whatever. And he asked me what I was, you know, what my role was or what I was doing on the production. And I said, I'm directing this. And he laughed. He
what?
Just laughed in my face. We hadn't even been talking for very long.
That's horrifying.
He just laughed. And you know, today, I mean, now I'm a lawyer, I'm a prosecutor, I work with cops and detectives, and I do feel like I have to talk to them differently.
Really?
Yeah, because I'm asking them to do things. I'm, right. You know, basically when a case is presented to our office and it gets filed, it's kind of, you know, obviously there has to be enough probable cause to believe, well, it's actually beyond probable cause, that this crime happened and that this person did it. Right. But it's kind of it's a seed. And if it's your case as the prosecutor, you're going to develop that case as much as you can. So you're thinking of what additional evidence might be out there. What additional workup can I ask for? You know, can I ask the detective to subpoena these records? Well, actually we would subpoena the records, but can I ask the detective to get a search warrant for these right. items? You know, this Facebook account, this, you know, these things that I, as a, you know, I can't get a search warrant. It's a cop who has to do that to get those things. So I do feel like I have to, you know, will you please, and then if they don't do it, you know, I'm just wondering if you happen to, you know, I don't feel like I can just be, hey, you know, we're on this clock. I need this done. This is the third time I'm at, you know, and because I've been yelled at by detectives who are telling me how to do my job.
Wow.
And so have other female DAs.
Sure.
So.
That's interesting. That's really interesting. Because I think, I don't know, like I would say there are personalities, whether they be creative, executive, writing, acting, to which I do have to sometimes speak to certain people in a certain way, for sure. Not so much, I feel like, with crew, but, you know, everyone on a set has a personality. And if they're a creative personality, sometimes that can bring, you just have to read the temperature of the room. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you have to know when to push and when not to push.
Yeah.
Or if an actor comes in and you can tell they're in a really bad mood and they don't like the scene, they don't feel comfortable. Like, that's where I'm always like, ooh, okay, we got to turn this one around quick.
Yeah. How are we going to work with this person today?
And so that's when I think I really feel like I turn on, like, you know, I'm not just being that person's like, time out. Let's go. You know,
right. You have to navigate it.
I do have to navigate, and I have to massage that relationship a little bit, because you have to make that person feel comfortable in order to get them to do what you'd like them to do, which I guess is what you're
saying. Leadership.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Well,
so to a degree, yeah, I guess now that you mention it, but that's really interesting. That it's still like that.
Yeah. And I've been with my friends, you know, fellow female DAs and asking male DAs in our unit, have you ever had a male detective yell at you and explain to you how to enter, I don't know, an estimate for damage to some property into evidence? Have you ever had a detective yell at you and teach you that? And they don't know what we're talking about.
Wow.
They haven't experienced that. So if you're out there, I'm curious, our listeners, and if you've had this experience, whatever field you may be in, I'm interested to hear what's going on out there. It's encouraging that, you know, in Hollywood, of all places today, people are realizing, oh, we can't treat the female director crappy or start undermining her and eye rolling her and right. on day one, knowing right. nothing.
I mean, listen, that's just been my experience, but I've also, maybe I'm still living in a bubble. maybe next year I'll have a new story for you.
I'm sure there's still stories out there, but for all of our listeners out there, I'd be interested to hear what yeah. your experiences are. Are you experiencing that's, you know, you're free of that, or is you still are laboring under that today? And
yeah, and I said this, like, I remember when I was starting to direct and I was writing a lot of these, you know, mission statements, I guess, statements of intent. When I was trying to get into various directing programs, they ask you to write like a one page of, why do you want to do this? Mm-hmm. Why do you want to be a director? And so one of the things I would say is that, you know, I've been in this business for 30 years and I can count on one hand the number of female directors I've worked with as an actor.
Yeah.
One hand.
Yeah.
Like that's, and I would say three of those were in the last 5 years. I mean, that's crazy when I think about, you know, who's telling the stories and who's, you know, who's behind a camera. That's like, it's not enough, people. It's not enough.
No. So please let us know.
Yes.
Tell us what your experience is out there as a female, whatever you are, engineer,
scientist, doctor,
builder, whatever it may be.
Manager.
Very interested to hear. Well, for next week, I actually will be recapping, it is season 1, episode 7, Yo-Yo's Wedding. Thank you very much for listening.
Thanks, everyone.
Yeah, I'm Stacey Keenan.
And I'm Christine Lakin.
And we hope we have given you deja vu. Until next time.
Ciao.
Thanks so much for listening. Be sure to like, subscribe, and leave us a review. We'd love to hear from you. Please write to us at keenanandlakin@gmail.com and follow us on social at @KeenanandLakin. We are so proud that our show is produced by the fabulous Stephen Ray Morris.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.